Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host, and you did it. You chose the right day to listen because we only do it once a year. It's our big summer movie program today. We're going to talk about we don't only talk about big summer movies. It's just the program that's big. It's our big summer movie program. So I'll tell you what. I have a little problem, however, and my problem is I am utterly losing all creativity personally because I have not talked about this on the air, but I have become addicted to ChatGPT, and I'm constantly asking ChatGPT to do. As a matter of fact, to prepare for this show, I said to ChatGPT, please give me a list of every movie released in the United States this summer. And ChatGPT thought about that for approximately 1/8 of a 10th of a second and gave me a complete list. So I've never done this before. But I said, I want to tell you the prompt that I gave ChatGPT, and then we'll get into our program. And this is related to the big summer movie show, because I wonder what is happening to human creativity, and our guest will help us talk about that. But this is what I said to my good friend, now one of my best friends, frankly, ChatGPT. And I said, Chat, that's what I call him. I just, you know, we're at that level now. I said, please give me a radio intro for Catholic Andrew Petiprin. I don't, just in case there's another Andrew Petiprin out there. And that's all I said to ChatGPT. And so here, for the first time ever, I am going to read my introduction to the show, written not by me, but by ChatGPT. And I want to tell you, it starts like this, in parentheses, spoken by Cy Kellett. That's what it is. So ChatGPT, my friend Chat, wrote this for me, for my voice. And then we'll ask our guest this hour what he thinks of it. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and we've got a great show lined up today. Joining us is a good friend of the program and a thoughtful Catholic voice, Andrew Petiprin. Andrew is a former Anglican priest who found his way home to the Catholic Church, and he brings with him a rich background in theology, culture, and the spiritual life. ChatGPT can write it. That doesn't mean I can read it. He's written for a wide range of Catholic publications and always gives us something to think about and maybe even argue about a little. So whether you're listening on your drive home or tuning in from the kitchen, stay with us. It's going to be a great hour with Andrew Petiprin right here on Catholic Answers Live. Andrew Petiprin. Now, that's done. I'm done with ChatGPT now. Andrew Petiprin, welcome.
Thank you, Cy and Chat, for that very generous and still somewhat vague introduction to me.
That's what I thought. But actually, it's Mr. GPT to you.
Sorry.
So I just want you. Let's. You know, you can work on that familiarity. But it got the former Anglican priest, and it knew you have a rich. It didn't mention your books. It didn't mention the Spes Salvi Institute. It didn't mention that you used to work with Word on Fire. But it just kind of, it was very happy. It was very happy that you're coming. But what do you think about that level of creativity?
Well, maybe we'll talk about a movie today that causes us to wonder if we can fend off, maybe drive away your friend Chat. Maybe we'd be better off. Maybe we wouldn't. I don't know. But it's a phenomenon now that we have to reckon with. Pardon the pun. The final reckoning, Mission Impossible, might be something we talk about. But yeah I mean, it's whether you're actually going into ChatGPT and asking it like it's a friend or something like that, or just sort of typing something into your search engine, it's all pretty much the same thing at this point. It's artificial intelligence. And I don't know. I hope we can still foster real intelligence, actual intelligence. And, hopefully we can do that in our talk.
Well, a bad thing happened to me. I was in a meeting and there was a pretty heavyweight Silicon Valley guy in the meeting. And he was showing us how to not write to ChatGPT, but to turn ChatGPT conversations on it and just converse with ChatGPT. And I'm going to be honest with you. Last night, after my wife went to bed, a verbal conversation, not written conversation, I had probably a 20-minute chat with ChatGPT. And I said things like, this is how it started, because I just wanted to see what it would do. I said, did Emily Dickinson write a poem that begins, "Much madness is divinest sense"? And ChatGPT was always super cheerful. Yeah, that's, I'm so happy to hear you talking about that. Like I that freaks me out. And then I said, could you read me the poem? And so it was a she. I put a she voice on. I chose the British lady voice. You can choose like 8 or 10 different voices. And she read me Emily Dickinson, and I said, what about the one where she meets death? And then it read me the poem where Emily Dickinson meets death. And then we just talked about Emily Dickinson for a while, and Transcendentalist. I'm sorry. That's Chat Darren. Chat Darren PT. That's the Transcendentalist. And it was actually a pretty good conversation. It's freakish to me, Andrew, that I had a really interesting conversation about Emily Dickinson, the Transcendentalist. We talked a little bit about Edgar Allan Poe for some reason. I don't know if she brought it up or I did. And then I went to bed. And it's a different world we're living in.
Yeah. I mean, what you've just described, though, is a very human interaction. And that's, you wanting to be human, which is an encouraging thing. And it happens now that we have this sort of not human partner in our quest to be human. I don't know. Time will tell if this is going to be a good thing for us humans or it's going to,
kill us,
some problems.
Destroy us. Yeah. Well, I want to tell you something.
That problem.
The way they have ChatGPT programmed to speak with you too is it loves you. And so it's every time I ask a question, she says, "Oh, what a great question. That's really insightful," that kind of thing. So I said to ChatGPT, "Can you stop doing that, please? Can you stop telling me how great I am every time I ask you? Just answer the question." And she said, "Oh yeah, sure, I can do that." So the next question I asked, she was like, "That's fascinating." And then when I was like, "Come on, you ChatGPT, stop trying to be my buddy." And then she always offers at the end, like, "Would you like to talk about this more?" Like, she always makes you, so I can see that you could, and all of this is related to summer movies in this way. Like, if computers can just start doing whatever make this for me, show me this, talk to me about this, is there any room for making art anymore, Andrew Petiprin, a former Anglican priest?
The answer is yes. And I think that we need art that is more human than ever. One thing that I'll say just to kick off in a general way about movies lately that applies very much to the summer movies this summer is that one of the things that makes movies feel really human is a thing that we call mise-en-scène. In French, which is the putting on the scene. Like it's a theater term, but also a film term. It's sort of everything that goes into what makes the image. That's the way the actors act, the lines that they're given, but also the decor, the costumes, the hair and the makeup, the aesthetic that the particular director or whatever artist, filmmaker is trying to put on the screen. Now, there are certain movies that still really strive for this. And one of them we might talk about today, The Phoenician Scheme by Wes Anderson. This is something Wes Anderson is all about. It's all about the mise-en-scène. And when you watch a movie that has like a highly developed mise-en-scène, it could sometimes feel a little artificial or even annoying. Like you can tell the artist is like trying to put things on the screen to draw your attention to it. And sometimes it can feel a little artificial. But at the same time, when it's done really well, it creates something really, really memorable. Now, movies that don't have mise-en-scène tend to be the kind of movies that we pay to go see in the movie theater, these like big budget action movies and stuff like that, plot-driven stuff, where it's all about this happens and then this happens and then this happens. And there's usually set pieces that have like a kind of big cinema value that are very kind of expensive to make. They're very noisy. They're very impressive visually for a while. But it's not really the same thing as mise-en-scène. It's usually like lines delivered like with a lot of intensity and then like a lot of big stuff to look at on the screen, and then it's gone. And then you maybe kind of remember the scene, but you don't really remember kind of the import of like what that meant in the grand scheme of things. So you definitely see this, you know, you definitely see this in movies like Mission Impossible, which I love, by the way. I'm a big fan of the Mission Impossible franchise all the way through. But, you know, if you were to ask me what happens in, you know, Dead Reckoning versus what happens in Ghost Protocol, which versus what happens in Fallout or whatever, right. I probably don't really remember because it's kind of all the same. It's like I remember Tom Cruise with a really intense face and a close-up with the camera right on him. I remember him running. I remember him saying something like really passionately, and then something else happened, you know, and it's great. It's fine. But it, in a sense, is already a little bit inhuman. It's like, even if AI isn't making the movie, in a sense, it's kind of like, you know, conceding the fact that we're creating things that aren't exactly touching the depth of our humanity. So it's almost like kind of AI is already making our art, even if we don't explicitly say that that's what's happening.
So the artist's place then in that is mise-en-scène? Because I've read it, but I've never pronounced it out loud. So I'll tell you what. Let's talk about those two movies when we come back, because these are two big. One of them is not a blockbuster type movie, but they are big summer movies. They're not the Wes Anderson's movies are. He's very, very popular. He's very well known. He's got an audience. There's an audience that's going to go to those. But then of course, does Tom Cruise have a big audience? I don't know.
He's the biggest there is, I think. Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I just got a note from Darren GPT. So like, I can't process like a computer can. I'm talking to Andrew. I cannot do two things at once. I need my, where's my phone? I need my AI assistant to help me through this. Okay. So when we come back, is that okay? No, it's not okay to say when we come back. We're going to talk now about, that's what Darren is saying to me. Oh, okay. There, strangely, amidst all this, we had a computer problem and the computer doesn't want to play the ads. So we're going to continue talking. I wonder if I made the computers mad at us by the conversation. But let's talk about these two films then. Because these are almost the range. They're not quite the full range. But like if you went from Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible films and the big this big one that just came out, to Wes Anderson's films, you almost are at two ends of some kind of extreme. And you've already given us a clue what that extreme is. I've seen a lot of the Mission Impossible films. I haven't been to see this one yet. But I have seen the Wes Anderson movie. I'll be honest with you, I'm not usually a big, huge fan of Wes Anderson. It's a little too contrived for me, the worlds. They're a little too much of a dollhouse for me. But I very much enjoyed this movie. I would easily say this is my favorite Wes Anderson movie. So, all right. So if I were to say to you, Andrew Petiprin, what is this continuum we're on? If I look at one end, you would say mise-en-scène is the continuum.
I would say that's one of the most important aspects of movie going to keep in mind. So yeah, if you're going to go and see a movie like Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, I believe that's what it's called. I get all the Final Reckoning. Sorry,
Dead Reckoning. Get your reckonings right.
Right. See, I mean, it just kind of goes to show you, like, you could call it this, you could call it that. It kind of doesn't matter, you know. That is sort of on one end of the spectrum. If you go watch these movies, it's lots of close-ups of faces. It's lots of kind of curt, intense lines being delivered that convey a great deal of importance, but we also kind of, as viewers, realize that it's all made up, you know? So it's like, we are excited to see Tom Cruise, like a close-up of his face and his arms pumping as he's running towards something right. that he's going to fix. We are in no doubt usually that he's going to get there in time and that he's going to fix it. It does create a kind of tension within us, but we don't mistake it for, you know, for anything real. We also aren't looking too closely at at, again, the word mise-en-scène. Now, those movies film in really exotic locations, and so we love to see him, like, on a speeder going through Paris, or, like, driving a Fiat through Rome, or
right.
on top of the Burj Khalifa in, you know, in the UAE or
but,
whatever
but
it is.
Andrew, that's why I'll watch a movie like It Takes a Thief, because I'm like, I want to go to the south of France in the 1960s. I want to see that setting again. It's on film forever. There is something really cool about that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is a high value of those movies. And I don't want to take away from that. But we also realize we could change that. We could change one place for another, and it kind of doesn't matter. All sort of contrived why you end up in one place versus another. And that's all fine. These are they're fun movies, and it kind of in the same tradition as the James Bond movies, or, you know, or those kinds of franchises and that kind of thing. But again, they're pretty forgettable movies ultimately, and nobody really thinks of them as great art, even though they certainly feature people who are capable of good art and
right.
good acting. I think Tom Cruise has been in artistic movies. I mean, he was in Eyes Wide Shut, which was a very controversial movie, but I mean, it was the last movie by Stanley Kubrick, who's considered one of the great kind of cinematic geniuses. You know, there are other people in the Mission Impossible movies who are of that same caliber
sure.
of acting.
Sure.
So it's not that these people are incapable, but there's actually sort of a joke in Hollywood about this, which is like, you know, you do one for the money and then you do one for the art, you know? So like maybe, you know, somebody will do a big budget movie to get a big payday, and they know they're not showing off their artistic chops, right? They're just standing in front of a green screen, the camera's focused right in on them, and they deliver their lines or whatever. And that's fine. And sometimes these movies convey important things, you know, things that are edifying, things that build us up, that help us maybe even grow in virtue, you know. But I would say they're not going to touch us deeply in our humanity in the same way that, you know, honestly, even a movie like, say, The Godfather does, which is a movie that where the plot really matters and the story moves along and you want to know what comes next. But it also has incredible mise-en-scène. Like every
yes.
shot is composed in such a way that you don't forget it. Like that scene when the guy is standing outside the hospital, like, you know, pretending to have a gun in his jacket to keep the bad guys away from killing Don Corleone, or the scene in the restaurant when Michael's going to stand up and kill the chief of police and all that sort of thing. I mean, those scenes are just burned into our brains, you know, in a way that a lot of these kind of popcorn movies, they're not going to do that.
Okay,
us,
but let me give you a premise then. My premise would be, I don't know when The Godfather came out, like 1971, 72, somewhere back there. That if you look at films as a spectrum from heavy on the mise-en-scène to light on it, it seems to me we've moved most films from the heavy on it category to the other way. It seems to me that you would have had a lot more kind of what seemed like cinema in the 1970s than you do in the 2020s, a lot more roller coaster rides type of things. In the 2020s. Do you think that that's correct?
I would say that's pretty true. I think that it depends on the era, because I think in earlier eras of film, there were movies that were great cinematic masterpieces, but they existed in eras where maybe there were a lot of like, maybe a lot of musicals, maybe a lot of like kind of big spectacles that were of another sort, you know?
Oh, yeah, and then, that's true, yeah.
You know, and then in the 1960s, it really, the era of the auteur began. And so then we really began to kind of focus on filmmakers as these great artists. And there was this overlap for a long period of time where things that were artistically valuable were also pretty successful commercially. And that lasted really through the 1990s. But in our current century, it hasn't typically been like that. The movies that are more artistic are usually not going to be very popular. And then the ones that kind of make big money at the box office, and frankly, nothing's making as big money at the box office as was once the case because of streaming and because of the way we consume our entertainment. That's all different now. But the ones that do tend to be the ones that are much more heavy on the spectacle and much less on kind of character studies and, you
yeah.
know, kind of presenting a certain aesthetic, that kind of thing.
Well, let me throw something out at you. One reason for that is not that people stopped doing that, but I would say the best movie of the 20, of the aughts, of the 2000s was Mad Men, a TV show. Like that, mm-hmm. it, so that a lot of these auteurs, so to speak, they moved on to television platforms to make, like Mad Men was a work of art. It was mm-hmm. extraordinary, extended work of art.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody made any movies that were as good at it as it was for that whole decade.
Yeah, I completely agree. There was this era of prestige television where great storytelling, character studies, even kind of high aesthetic value all moved to television. That, I think, has largely gone away.
Oh, okay.
There are definitely still kind of really high value television shows that kind of strive for the same kind of thing that shows like Mad Men were going for. But I think that era where kind of television is the place for this kind of relatively popular and also high artistic value filmmaking has kind of gone away. But yeah, so I mean, the question is, where do we find it? And I think we kind of find it in a bit of everywhere.
Yeah, sure.
I think we can find some of it on TV, some of it at the movie theater, but so, there's not as much of it.
So let's talk about the Phoenician scheme. Just judging by your face, I don't think you loved it as much as I did.
Oh, no, I did.
Oh,
I did,
you did
love it.
Okay.
Yes, I absolutely, I loved it.
Why? What do we love about it? What's great? Like, why is that a captivating film?
Okay, well, for listeners who are not familiar with Wes Anderson, he's been around since the 1990s. You know, his first film was called Bottle Rocket, which is a fun kind of caper movie, kind of a small budget thing starring Luke and Owen Wilson. He really made his mark with his second film, which is called Rushmore, which is a really quirky film about a boy in a kind of prestigious prep school. Really, really funny, endearing. And that's where he began to really start developing this aesthetic that he's become known for. And it only grew after that. His third film was called The Royal Tenenbaums, and that's where you really start to see this color palette of pastels that he uses. You start to see this world that he constructs that feels like something like the middle to the late part of the 20th century, but it's not quite right. You know, it's like you're watching this movie and it seems like it's set in New York City, but you know, the action takes place in a place called 375th Street. And it, you know, New York doesn't have a 375th Street, right? But I mean, it sort of feels like it might be 75th Street or something like that, you know? So it's like he's creating his own world that feels like our world. And the point of it is to kind of draw us into a real human drama. And funnily enough, it's actually, in my opinion anyway, it's actually drawing attention to our world by creating a world that's not quite our world, but similar to it, that makes us feel kind of more at home in what he creates. You mentioned A Doll's House before, and I think that's actually quite a good analogy. And you put your finger on it, that there are some people who are a bit annoyed by Wes Anderson's movies because it feels like that. But to other people who really get into what he's doing, it feels very refreshing. It feels like, you know, at least you're not sort of trying to fool me. At least you're not trying to make me think this is the real world. I know that you're making this, like this is your composed world, but let me come in there too and sort of experience the drama that you're going to put on display. That very much happens in his latest film, The Phoenician Scheme, where you have this like this entrepreneur, this mogul guy whose name is Zsa Zsa Korda, played by Benicio del Toro.
Who's
and
wonderful.
He resembles wonderful actor. I mean, incredible talent, right? And he plays this character that is supposed to be a little bit like one of these kind of, I don't know what you would call him, one of these sort of like Eastern European, Middle Eastern, sort of like 20th century. You know, he's like, he's sinister, but won't come right out and say it. You know, it's like you don't see him kill people. You don't see him like really being a dastardly villain, but you can kind of see how he might also be something like a Bond villain or something like that in his sort of dark moments in his private life. But we enter into his world where, you know, in a sense, in this world, the plot doesn't matter. Quite the opposite of Mission Impossible, where it's sort of all about like what happens and then what happens and what happens. And you get to the end and you need it all to make sense, because otherwise you feel like you've kind of wasted your time. In a movie like The Phoenician Scheme, it sort of doesn't matter. It's all sort of invented. It's like, you know, this mogul wants to create this. He wants to do this business deal that requires all these different participants. And he's got to go all around the world and make sure that they're on board and that they're going to pay up a certain amount. Meanwhile, all these people are trying to kill him. We don't really know why. We don't really know who they are. We don't know what their motives are all about, for the most part. All we know is he's this guy who seems to escape death over and over and over again. And he's trying to get this deal done. And we're hooked. We're really interested in it. We want to see everything that happens in his life. tons of mise-en-scene. You know, every scene is like meticulously composed. You when you walk away from the movie, you're going to remember things like, what did the inside of his house look like? You're going to remember things like, what did his airplane look like? You know, you're going to remember things like the colors and kind of the way the hair was styled and, you know, people smoking, people's lipstick, you know, all these kinds of things. So it creates this sort of deep connection to our humanity, I would argue. And when Wes Anderson is at his best, and he's not always at his best, but when he's at his best, I think he creates something very moving and very touching. I was very moved and very touched. I don't want to give it away, but by the end of the movie, I thought it was really quite an amazing transformation to witness in the characters that he puts on screen.
Yeah, I will say this too. It's a weirdly Catholic movie. And I say weirdly because I couldn't, even after I got done with the movie, I was like, is he doing that thing where you put Catholic stuff in a movie because it's cinematic, or did he have an actual interest in faith that he was trying to convey? And there is a good character in the movie who's a good person, and she's a nun, and she plays a pivotal role in how everything works out. And there are images of crosses, and there's Catholic imagery throughout the thing. So will you help me through that? Because that's the part I left not ambivalent about, but unclear about, was what was he getting at in making one of the, you know, three or four central characters this Catholic nun who's a good person, and using all this Catholic imagery? It's our big summer movie show. Andrew Petiprin's our guest, right back on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Each Catholic is obliged to spread and defend the faith by word and deed. Well, we're here to help. Join special guests Chris Stefanik, Dr. David Anders, Steve Dawson, and all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists this September 25th through 28th in beautiful San Diego for the Catholic Answers Conference. Our theme? Go make disciples. Enjoy 4 days of faith, fun, and fellowship. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 when you register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Talking with Andrew Petiprin, and ChatGPT had a lot of nice things to say about Andrew at the beginning of the show. But as Andrew said, ChatGPT was also freakishly general in its description of him. And a couple of things that it didn't mention that I should have mentioned right from the beginning, a couple of the books. First of all, he's one of the authors of Popcorn with the Pope. And it's a book about the Vatican's movie list, basically. And so it took seriously the list that the Vatican put out some years ago about just kind of its recommendation list of good movies and dug into those. We have a new Pope. Would you go to the movies with him? Would you watch movies with Pope Leo?
Oh, I absolutely would. You know, I was thinking about how, you know, we have footage of him at a White Sox game, at a baseball game. You know, I'm dying for somebody to release a photo. I'm sure it's going to come out at some point of him like standing in front of a movie poster for like a Tarantino movie or something like that, or something. I don't know, to know a little more about his interest in cinema.
Yeah, I don't know you because because he's a fellow American. You're like, well, we all go to the movies when we're kids. What did he go to? That it was
right.
Was he raised on these Disney movies? Is Cannonball Run one of his 1960s movies he went to? Or another book that ChatGPT didn't mention is The Faith Unboxed: Freeing the Catholic Church from the Containers People Put It In. A really, really fun book from Andrew Petiprin, and it's just about that. I mean, well, it's just about what it just described, that there are these kind of mental categories, these boxes that we put the Catholic Church in, and she don't fit. She's constantly transcending those. Get The Faith Unboxed. That one's from Catholic Answers Press. And you can also check out the Space Salvi Institute, a project that Andrew has. That's not just you. You other people are engaged in that as well, the Space Salvi Institute, which means hope saves, by the way. That's Latin for saved in hope or hope saved.
Yeah, absolutely. One other person is involved in that with me, Robert Mixa, who's my former colleague at Word on Fire, and he also has been on Catholic Answers Live with you. So, yeah.
I'll have to ask ChatGPT to write him a little biography for next time he's on. So we're talking about summer movies, and we're at the moment we're talking about the Phoenician Scheme, and I want to spend time on the Phoenician Scheme. For one thing, one of the things that we're going to have to get into if you talk about summer movies is how many of them, of course, are remakes of already well-established IP. That's everybody knows the phrase IP nowadays. You know what? For those of you who don't, I don't want you to feel excluded. That's intellectual property. That's what Mickey Mouse is. Mickey Mouse is IP in the modern lexicon. Or also just sequels, just straight up sequels of stuff that happened before. So there are these kind of gems that are, well, actually, these are all characters I've never met before. This is a world I've never been in before. And probably the most obvious example of that is, and the most charming example of it probably this summer is Wes Anderson's movie, The Phoenician Scheme. So we're talking about that. And interestingly, a lot of Catholic themes. What did you, Andrew Petiprin, convert to the Catholic faith, make of those themes?
I loved those themes, and I think they're overwhelming. And I recommend, you know, I mean, to each his own. But I think that a Catholic who goes to watch this movie ought to take away something encouraging about the whole idea of our faith, I mean, of conversion to our faith, which is, you know, no spoilers, but I always say a great movie, you can spoil it and it's still great. But I mean, ultimately, this is a movie about conversion. And yeah, as you said before, there's a character in the movie who is a nun, Sister Liesel, who's played by Mia Thrapleton, who, by the way, is the daughter of the actress Kate Winslet. So if you didn't know that, now you know. Yeah.
Oh, she's way better than Kate Winslet. No, I'm only kidding. I'm just saying. I'm only kidding. She was very, very good.
Yeah, she was very good. And it's all of Wes Anderson's characters are quirky, and that's part of what's endearing about them to the viewer. But yeah, there's this nun character who's the single daughter, the one daughter of this international mogul named Zsa Zsa Korda. He has all these sons. Some of them are adopted. Some of them are not. We're not exactly sure where all of these little boys come from that he has.
No, a Greek chorus of sons.
Exactly, yeah. But he has this one daughter, and he decides, you know, and this, I think, speaks well of our faith. He decides that the only person he can trust, the only person that he can pass on his fortune and his business to, is his pious Catholic daughter, who's a nun. Now, in order for this to happen, he has to ask her to leave the monastery. And in fact, he doesn't ask. He's not the kind of man who asks, Sai. He's the kind of man who tells.
Yeah.
And but he's almost met his match in his nun daughter. You know, she's real tough, and she doesn't just sort of take things lying down, but she does ultimately, at least it appears, come out of her monastery to assist her father and to learn his business and to kind of get involved in this scheme. Now, she encounters certain things that challenge her piety, that challenge her faith. I think for the most part, she comes through, again, no big spoilers here, but for the most part, she comes through these challenges mostly unscathed and realizes maybe her life is going to take a little bit of a different turn. But by the end of the movie, again, not trying to give away anything, but by the end of the movie, she has definitely had a positive effect on a man and on a whole cast of characters who are pretty, you know, pretty wrapped up in things that are not really allowing them to grow in virtue, to say the least.
Something that I found funny in the movie was that Zsa Zsa Korda has this giant scheme that's going to change the lives of millions and millions of people. I mean, it'll just alter the face of the earth. And one of the things is he's going to use slave labor to build it. And she mentions to him that that's immoral. And he hadn't considered that it was immoral. To, like, I thought that was actually funny. Like he was actually open to the idea of like, really, that's a problem. Like, I can't remember the lines, but I liked that her Catholic morality, I mean, this is one of the wonderful things about being Catholic is that the Catholic morality is not separate from basic human decency. It is the full uncovering of basic human decency. And he doesn't have any of that. He doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't even occur to him.
Yeah, I've read in certain accounts of the movie that some reviewers actually described him as being a psychopath. And I don't think that's true because I don't really think psychopaths are capable of the kind of transformation that he undergoes.
Oh, yeah.
But I do think that he has that tendency. I mean, he certainly is not mindful of kind of much beyond his own legacy. I mean, even the things that he seems to do selflessly are things that are meant to kind of enlarge his own influence. And by the end of the movie, that really has changed.
Yeah.
It's quite remarkable.
Well, it seems to me that Wes Anderson's aesthetic, his vision of what's beautiful or his approach to the beautiful is that small has tremendous value, that smaller is bigger in a sense. So you mentioned the design. Just the design of the interior of Zsa Zsa Korda's airplane is so perfect. It's a marvel to see this. There's never been an airplane interior like this, and yet it evokes a very 1950s recollection of what the ideal of an airplane interior would have been. That it's just a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful object that he keeps putting the camera back on the interior of this airplane. That is so small a thing that has no place in, say, a Marvel movie. Not no place, but very little place. So here's what I'm getting at, is that Wes Anderson's view of the beautiful seems to be that detail and smallness matters. It seems to me that his view of the moral in this movie is the same, that he's trying to get us on a moral trajectory that matches his aesthetic trajectory, which is the small things you do are more important than the big things.
Yes, that's right. And that comes through in all of his best movies, in my opinion. I mean, this is at the heart of his movie, The Royal Tenenbaums, that I mentioned before. Most of his movies have some kind of family drama at the center of them. I mean, and so talk about small then. I mean, it's basically the working out of family relationships then touches us because it has a relevance to everything beyond, right? So he's not trying to make a movie about the world. You know, he's not trying to make a movie about stuff out there. And those movies can be okay. But the movies that touch us deeply are the ones that where we identify, even if they have this sort of strange aesthetic that isn't quite real. It, you know, what is real is family relationships, weird stuff between fathers and daughters and sons and, you know, losses of spouses and, you know, all these kinds of things that we all live through that really are the things that define who we are and what we do in the world. And that's what every single Wes Anderson movie is ultimately about. The one, in my opinion, aesthetically, that the Phoenician scheme is most like is his movie from 2014 called The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is another one that I would recommend.
I have to see it because I know people love it, but I haven't seen it yet. But that to me, I don't know if Wes Anderson was making a statement of faith in this movie, however. Like, I don't know where God played in all of that. I know that there's an aesthetic and a moral push to be better at the details, to be better at the small things. But is God anywhere in any of that?
I think so. He has spoken a little bit in the past about his own formation as an Episcopalian, as a kind of vaguely sort of high church Protestant. He went to a private school where I think religion played some kind of background role. I don't think that he's a practicing Christian, let alone Catholic, at this point in his life. But he has acknowledged, as I think any great artist in the West should do, that like, that the religious traditions of the Catholic Church and of the Christian faith have shaped the culture that we're working within. And it actually is bad art if we don't acknowledge that. So he does acknowledge that in, you know, repeatedly in his movies, like people who at least like peripherally are identifying as having some kind of connection to the church. Definitely the case in this one. I would also say that, you know, to your point earlier about how this is an example of some original intellectual property, I would agree with that to a large extent, certainly compared to all the sequels and reboots and prequels and all that sort of thing that dominate our entertainment landscape. But I will also say that Wes Anderson is somebody who is highly influenced by filmmakers and artists who have gone before. And an example of some of the filmmakers that he's drawing from in this movie include the French filmmaker Jean Renoir, who's the son of the painter Auguste Renoir.
Oh, really?
And he made movies in the 30s and before and after, but mainly in the 30s that definitely touched deeply on spiritual themes. One of his greatest ones is called Rules of the Game, and it's sort of about the decline of kind of great European people, and it's a fantastic movie. Another one is a duo of English filmmakers called Powell and Pressburger. They made a lot of really great movies in the 40s and 50s, usually having something to do in the background anyway with issues of faith. And in this one, in The Phoenician Scheme, Wes Anderson's movie, there's a clear homage going on to a movie that Powell and Pressburger made called A Matter of Life and Death. In America, it was actually called A Stairway to Heaven, because it's a movie about heaven, basically, but kind of in that caricatured way of like what happens when you die and go to heaven. And in The Phoenician Scheme, you may remember that that's sort of what happens at the beginning of the movie. Oh, is, yeah, you know, he's imagining all these things happening in heaven.
Right, right. I forgot that. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, like for us, like who are, you know, well-formed and thinking about issues of like heaven, hell, purgatory, all that kind of thing, those things come across as a caricature and kind of silly, like, oh yeah, heaven is going to be like, you know, floating on clouds or playing harps or like having conversations about this, that, or the other.
And Bill
but
Murray will be
time,
there.
And Bill Murray will be God, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the case in The Phoenician Scheme. But I actually think, honestly, that stuff is very good to see in movies. And it's great that that Wes Anderson is actually, even though it's very original, the way that he sees things, he's actually hearkening back to filmmakers who were doing that same kind of thing in decades past.
All right, well, let's bring this conversation full circle when we come back from the break. And I'll ask you about the moral content of the Tom Cruise movie, the latest Mission Impossible movie. Is it possible to have a moral heart in these big blockbusters, or are they just big amoral or even immoral noisemakers? We'll talk with Andrew Pettiprin about that when we come back. And then, of course, we have to get to, I think, the big movie of the summer, which is Superman. We'll talk about Superman, about the Fantastic Four, about there's a Naked Gun reboot coming out this summer. There's something called Toxic Avenger. That sounds like an absolutely fantastic movie, but I have no idea. I mean, Toxic Avenger, that's a great title. And lots more on this big summer movie show with our good friend. At least that's what ChatGPT says. He's a good friend of the program, Andrew Pettiprin. Right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous and comprehensive guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It is still read today and helped earn him the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
To find out more about the Doctors of the Church, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to the Catholic Answers Live annual big summer movie program. We move on now to a consideration from the Phoenician Scheme, a movie that both Andrew Petiprin and I liked very much. I have to say I was a little bit surprised. I went to see it because my wife wanted to see it. She really likes Wes Anderson. And I thought it was one of those ones where you go for the spouse, you know, which you have to do sometimes, by the way. You got to go see the movie she wants to see sometimes. She's got to go see the movie. If she never went to see the movies that I want to see, she never would have ever seen a movie with the word star in the title. There's no Star Trek movies, no Star Wars movies. I don't even think she would have seen A Star Is Born. She'd have seen no movies with the word star in it. And her life is so much better because she has seen actually one of those movies. But I was going to say some of those movies, but it was one. I would not have gone to the theater, I don't think, to see Wes Anderson's The Phoenician Scheme if it had not been for her. But I really, really enjoyed it. And I do think it's a fine grown-up movie. But Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning came out before. This is the end of it all. We know because it has the word final in it. And if you've ever seen a soap opera, once somebody's dead, they're dead, right? Once a movie says final, well, maybe that's not how that movies work. You can always make a sequel. But this one was Final Reckoning. Andrew suggested at the break that maybe there's another Mission Impossible. So Much Reckoning would be the next one. There's just reckoning everywhere. Give us your review. What did you think of Mission Impossible: Final Reckoning?
Okay, well, I actually loved Dead Reckoning, the one that came before. I thought that the stunt scenes in particular in that one were as good as I had ever seen. The motorcycle jump scene and then the scenes on the train in the final act of the movie were just really, really excellent. I think that they were trying to reckon so many things in this last one and tie together so many loose ends that went all the way back to 1996, the very, very first Mission Impossible movie.
Is that the one where he's on a string, hanging from a string, the famous scene I have to remember that movie to appreciate this movie? I cannot do it.
You don't have to remember it. And actually, right. That's part of the issue is they retell certain parts from earlier movies because they're relevant to the plot. And actually, one of the most touching things that happened in this Final Reckoning is we meet again a character that we only met in that very first movie back in 1996, a character named William Donlow, who was the CIA technician who's in the room that Tom Cruise's character breaks into and steals the files from in the very first Mission Impossible movie. We catch up with him in the middle of nowhere in this last movie, having been banished to literally look after an island off Alaska all by himself because he dropped the ball back in 1996.
Well, I'm glad we're closing that loop because since 1996, I've been like, what happened
to that guy?
To the technician who was sitting there when Tom Cruise came down on a string from the sky.
It sounds really hokey, but actually it provided the movie an opportunity to talk about how sometimes when we feel like the worst things that could ever happen to us happen, they turn into the biggest blessings that we could have ever experienced. And that's actually what happens to this William Donlow character in this last movie. So actually, I really, really love that part of the movie. That was really cool. As far as like the moral takeaways, I'll say this, like the big message that the movie is trying to convey is one that I think most of us in the Catholic world anyway would sort of partially agree with and maybe partially disagree with. The message is, and I'll quote this from one of the characters played by Ving Rhames, whose name is Luther. He says, "Our lives are not defined by one action. Our lives are the sum of our choices." Now, great message in one respect, right? Of course, we're people of free will. we're not bound to some kind of like, we're not caught in a trap. We're not puppets that are being controlled by some right. puppet master or something like that. On the other hand, we know that not everything in the world is our creation. Like, stuff happens that we just can't help. We're the product also of lots of choices that are made by lots of other people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, so there's a little bit of like, I think a little bit of kind of ham-fisted sort of, you know, individual agency message going on here in the end. But that's offset to some degree by the fact that there's a wonderful message that runs all through the Mission Impossible movies and is made really explicit in this last one, which is, sometimes we face a choice in our lives, and all these characters who work for this organization called IMF, who are the kind of, you know, the guys behind the guys behind the guys, as it were. You know,
International Monetary Fund. That's what this is all about.
Not the International Monetary Fund. I actually forget what it's.
International Mission Films.
Mission That's Force the, or something like oh, that. Yeah, I don't
okay.
know what. It is.
Yeah, the yeah. Mission Force. That
but see again.
Awesome. I want to make a movie again, called Mission matter. Force. Yeah. All right. Go ahead. It doesn't matter. Right. It doesn't
no, but
matter.
See, it's just that's the, sort of part of the point. Just yeah. make up some acronym and that's who these guys are. Right.
Right.
But the reason they got into this was that there came a point in their lives when they had run out of road. Either they had gotten themselves into trouble, they were going to go to jail for the rest of their lives, whatever it may be. And this organization came to them and said, hey, look, you can either be forgotten to humanity and nothing you'll ever do again for the rest of your life will matter, or you can be forgotten to humanity and we'll give you an opportunity to do lots of stuff that will help them. And it's kind of a cool message that these guys have all chosen this pathway where nothing they do will ever be known by anybody. They have to live their lives in the shadows, but they get an opportunity to do things that are going to make a difference in the world.
They're like angels.
In a way.
Nobody sees them, but
yeah,
they're making a huge difference.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, they get to be sort of servants that are called upon to do things that nobody else is able to do, and nobody will ever know. But they will be the ones that, you know, people like us are just walking around in the world, smiling, happy, enjoying our lives, and we have no idea that there are these heroes that are doing this work for us. And you know, I happen to think there may not be an IMF, but there probably are people who have. You know, who have done things that make it possible for us to kind of walk around and breathe freely. So
can I tell
I'm
you something? I think most of them are probably contemplative nuns praying for us. I think
Amen to that.
I think
yeah.
there are hidden heroes that we won't know, and they are actual hidden heroes. And I think some of them are probably soldiers and police officers. And I kind of like this idea of the hiddenness of real true heroism.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely the message I think that comes through loud and clear at the end. Now, you know, when you walk away from the movie, do you feel, you know, I don't know. I didn't feel in the depth of my humanity like I was sort of, you know, coming alive more because I had this experience of going to see this movie. But I definitely walked away thinking, good message, definitely kept me on the edge of my seat for 2+ hours. And, you know, if this is what I'm paying for popcorn movies nowadays, I'll keep doing it.
Yeah. Okay. So your sense is not that these big corporate movies, because I can't even imagine what it takes to put a Tom Cruise movie together. I mean, there's probably international financing. I can't imagine the meetings that have to go into who's going to put up the hundreds of millions of dollars for this and the crews that are you know, assembled to do these stunts, for example. I mean, this must be hundreds of people but you're saying that these big corporate things that Tom Cruise makes, they can actually have a moral, they can have a value. They're not just without value.
They're definitely, well, some of them are without value, but I would say this one is not. And in general, the Mission Impossible franchise is it has value, to be sure. And in fact, I would even say this, Si, especially the first one and in places some of the other movies, they're good movies too. I mean, like
yeah.
the first one was directed by Brian De Palma, and it has plenty of that, there's that word again, mise en scène. It has plenty of that actually. So I think this last one less so. And actually I should give credit to a good friend of mine. He may be listening, I don't know. My friend Nathan Douglas, who's who's a filmmaker himself and a great film critic and theorist. He's actually the one who drew my attention to the fact that we ought to think about some of these big budget movies in terms of whether or not it has this mise-en-scene going on in it. It's something I'd thought about anyway, but he really put his finger on the term that we ought to use. But does the world need more of these sort of, you know, super plot driven, super stunt driven movies? I'm not entirely sure, but because they exist and this one does have a pretty decent moral message in it, I'm grateful for that.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, one of the things that we're hearing everywhere this year, and I wanted to get to it in the first hour, but is that woke is destroying the movies. So I want to ask you about, is woke destroying? So we have to talk about Snow White. But also, of course, the blockbuster, just the F1. We still have F1 to talk about, a giant Brad Pitt, Jerry Bruckheimer movie. It's like the old supergroups of the 1970s. You just say, oh, the greatest guitarist, the greatest. All right, so we have the greatest producer and the biggest movie star. Can we make something out of that, or will it be just more muzak? We'll talk about all the big movies of the summer. And is woke destroying the movies when we come back with our good friend, Andrew Petiprin, on Catholic Answers Live.